Hey, I'm Annie Corrigan at Earth Eats. Before we get started today, I want to introduce you to a fifth-generation farmer.
I'm Rance, R-A-N-C-E, Stout, S-T-O-U-T.
He's 12, and he's here with his mom, Linda. Their family farm is called Stout's Melody Acres. I walked up to their table as they were still getting everything organized for the morning. Rance is in charge of setting out samples of their sorghum. It's a sweetener that's as dark and viscous as molasses. Rance helped produce the sorghum all the way from cultivation of the crops to pouring the syrup into these little plastic cups.
Well, it's basically, it grows like on a stalk, but like corn. It looks like corn, but there's like, they're not really berries, but they're kind of like grainy stuff on the top, and we like pour it up through a press and get the sorghum like juice out, and then we like cook it down for like probably like 4 hours.
Can I try some?
Sure.
Ooh, I love that.
And you can like, some people put it in their coffee, and you can do it like stuff like, you can use it pretty much like honey.
But earthier than honey, a really complex and deep flavor. Rance isn't drinking coffee just yet. He prefers his mom's sorghum cookies. For a seventh grader, Saturdays are a prime day for sleeping in, but he beat the sunrise this morning by a couple hours.
4:45, yeah.
You don't seem too tired. You seem okay.
Yeah, I'm used to it. I guess I really don't have a choice, so.
Mom, what do you think about that?
He has a choice. He could go with Dad and sleep an extra hour, but he chose to come with me today, so. Oh, it's nice to have just a day one-on-one with my son. He's a good help. He enjoys the plants, and he enjoys visiting with people.
I'll walk around. Thanks for chatting with me.
Yes.
I took that sample of sorghum with me, and I finished it as I wandered around the market that morning. It got me thinking about, well, first of all, just how sensible it is for farmers to offer free tastes of their products. It brings people to your table, gives you a chance to make a personal connection with someone, and maybe you've just cultivated a future customer. There's also a level of trust there. The farmers put in the time, the effort, and the money up front with the hope that samplers will then become customers. It's similar to what we do here at Earth Eats. The radio show is free, so is the podcast. The website and the Twitter feed also available to anyone. But the time, effort, and money it takes to produce all these different products is real. So today, I'm asking you to help us with some of that cost. Even the smallest financial contribution means a lot to us here at Earth Eats. Visit eartheats.org, click Give Now in the upper right, WFIU Public Radio. It takes just a few minutes, and thanks. Okay, here's the show.
Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
In the United States, particularly in the last 30 years or so, the concept of terroir has increasingly become part of the lexicon of people who I call taste producers.
Like artisan cheesemakers, small-time bread bakers, winemakers, and chefs, Amy Trubeck studies taste and its connection to place. We speak with her in today's show. Distance is one of the main barriers to treatment for rural cancer patients. Harvest Public Media looks at how researchers are trying to fix that. A look also at what it takes to grow local veggies in Wyoming. Foragers will love our recipe for chicken of the woods mushrooms. And to kick off farmers market season, we take a stroll around Bloomington's bustling market to talk with some farmers on a chilly spring morning. A look at food stories that made headlines with Luann Johnson.
As we reported last week, California Governor Jerry Brown has proposed a 25% cut in urban water use, including on golf courses, campuses, and cemeteries. But urban water use only amounts for less than 25% of all water use total. His proposal for agricultural, a major source of water usage, is slightly less drastic, leading some to question Brown's decision. Those in California's agriculture sector see it differently. Over 400,000 acres of farmland went unplanted last year, and only the farmers with the most senior water rights will see any of the irrigation waters for their land. Plants like almonds and lettuce require more water than other agriculture, and some argue for a shift in plants that are more drought tolerant. 9 turkey farms in Minnesota have been infected with bird flu. It's believed the current outbreak was spread by migratory birds who showed no symptoms. Kansas, Missouri, South Dakota, and Arkansas have all reported bird flu outbreaks on turkey farms as well, but Minnesota has been hit the hardest by H5N2. Minnesota is the country's largest turkey-producing state. Birds are vaccinated for bird flu, but this particular strain is new to the U.S. H5N2 is not infecting humans. And the results are in. Vermont-based local food advocacy group, Strolling of the Heifers, has released its Locavore Index for 2015. For the last 4 years, the group has ranked all 50 states and the District of Columbia according to government data on per capita availability of local food. Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, and Oregon took the top 4 spots, keeping the same rankings they had last year. Desert states, Nevada and Arizona, ranked in the bottom 4, along with Florida and Texas. This year, the index took into account new information from the Census on Agriculture, which tracks local food sales at farmers markets, CSAs, and online sales. Indiana, by the way, ranked number 35. See where your state is listed. We've tweeted the article at Earth Eats.
There's more to these stories. A collection of links is included in this week's podcast post, so you can read more. EarthEats.org. You'll also notice the red Give Now button in the upper right. Click that, choose WFIU Public Radio, contribute what you can, and become an active member of the Earth Eats community. Lou Ann Johnson does her part every week, and it is appreciated.
Glad to do it, Annie.
Cancer is more likely to be fatal for people in rural areas than for most city residents. But it is hard to know why. Rural patients often live hours away from their doctors and even farther from researchers. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports on a project trying to bring cutting-edge research closer to home.
Just over a year ago, Tracy Detlefs learned she has stage 1 breast cancer. Since then, she figures she's charted some 10,000 miles, traveling from her farm in central Nebraska to area hospitals for treatment. Every surgery, every round of chemotherapy and radiation was a road trip.
Radiation treatments, usually only about 5 minutes a day that they actually have to see you. But for a week, for 7 weeks in a row, you're driving every single day to the cancer treatment center. We're about an hour away from the cancer centers.
Life was already busy. Detlefs holds down 3 nursing jobs and looks after 7 children and stepchildren.
Come on, baby.
And back on the farm near Loup City, Nebraska, Tracy and her husband keep a small herd of Black Angus cattle. I visited during calving season. Walking through a dusty corral, she spotted a newborn lying in the sun.
Love to see a healthy baby on the ground. Yeah, Sean and I both grew up with cattle, and so this is kind of probably our first love. If we won the Powerball, this is what we'd be doing.
But Detlefs says at times during her treatment, the cows had to take a back seat.
We work our full hours and then come home about 6 o'clock at night or so. So sometimes we're out here chasing cows in the dark.
That's not unusual for rural cancer patients. Distance is one of the main barriers to treatment. It's also a barrier for research.
How bad is it? Nausea? Do you have nausea?
At the cancer clinic in Hastings, Nebraska, Dr. Sikyo Shopur, who treated Tracy Detlefs, is seeing another patient who came all the way from Kansas.
And our service area extends from South Dakota to Kansas and west into Nebraska Panhandle.
Shopur says rural patients are underrepresented in research. The big research centers are at urban hospitals in places like Omaha, Denver, Kansas City, or Iowa City. So urban patients have good access to the leading research.
The rural people don't, and it's a loss for both sides, loss for the patients.
He says researchers could be missing environmental and genetic factors that could be unique to rural cancer patients. The University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha started to bridge the gap a few years ago by creating the Breast Cancer Collaborative Registry. Cancer patients provide blood and tumor samples and fill out questions about their family history and lifestyle. Researchers comb the database for patterns.
It collects a lot of cultural information, collects a lot of racial information, collects a lot of age, you know, a lot of genealogy information.
Dr. Edibaldo Silva at the Nebraska Medical Center says the registry allows researchers to ask questions they haven't asked before. And perhaps in the future, a patient's treatment can be tailored to their cancer's genetic ID.
We'd like to be able to say that a given genetic signature or profile will give us more information than the standard microscopic exam that we've used in the last 200 years. But that takes lots and lots and lots and lots of information.
More than 20 hospitals are collecting data from states like Colorado, Nebraska, Iowa, and the Dakotas. More than 2,000 patients are enrolled in the breast cancer registry so far, including Tracy Detlefs from Loup City. And as more sign on, Detlefs hopes researchers will learn if there's anything that raises the cancer risk for rural patients.
I think you're finding if there's any common environmental factors, if it could be anything related to our area that we live in, water we drink, if it's our diets that are different, anything like that is going to help us find different ways to try to prevent it in the future generations.
The good news for Detlefs is that her prognosis is good. It appears the radiation and chemotherapy have worked, and now her case is in the breast cancer registry. She says after an exhausting year living with cancer, it's encouraging to know something good could come from it. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Amy Trubeck studied cooking at Le Cordon Bleu Cooking School, but she decided that 60 to 80 hours a week in front of a hot stove just wasn't for her. So instead of cooking food, she decided to study it. Trubeck is an associate professor in nutrition and food science at the University of Vermont. She visited students at Indiana University's Food Studies program to talk about her research with Vermont maple syrup and artisan cheeses. She collaborated with various producers in the state to understand the importance of social relations to people's sensory experiences of food.
Sort of when I say social experience is sensory experience is social experience, that you're the when you taste food and you say, wow, I really like this cheese. A lot of what makes you have a sense of preference for that cheese comes from your social experiences. So how your community or your natural environment are shaping your actual sensory moment.
Isn't part of the problem then with our food system these days is that a lot of people don't see eating as a social or cultural experience. They're eating in their cars as they're going to or from places. I mean, is that the big problem?
I think that, yes, we don't pay enough attention in general to the sensory experience. I think there are other cultures where social dialogue about, well, what do you think about this food? Why do you think this is good? You know, when you're either within your family or in a kind of a communal setting, yes, I think we pay less attention. I would say that I don't think that particularly in the traditional European puritanical food culture of the United States, you were ever supposed to pay attention. So I would not blame it exactly on eating in your car, but I don't think eating in your car is any help.
Well, let's talk about your book, The Taste of Place, A Cultural Journey into Terroir. What is terroir? Define that for me.
Terroir is a French term that I actually translated as the taste of place, as the way that I thought I could best explain what it is. And a lot of what I talk about in the book is, in fact, because I do research and researchers like things to be complicated. So it's, in fact, an untranslatable term. So, and one of the reasons it's untranslatable is because it's so much about the context of France and what they value in France. But for the American audience, I will say that it is really about the relationship of people in a natural environment and the food that it's made in that relationship between people and a certain natural environment. And it's about the taste, what you can say about how that food tastes and how you can say that that food tastes a certain way because of where it comes from or because of who made it or both. In the United States, particularly in the last 30 years or so, the concept of terroir has increasingly become part of the lexicon of people who I call taste producers. So people that are in the work of making food of quality. So winemakers, cheesemakers, chefs, you know, bread makers. There's tons of people that are doing this kind of artisan work now who are very committed to what makes it good, and they oftentimes use recourse to a concept of terroir.
Can you try to explain why there's this boom in the artisan food movement now?
A lot of it is about post-World War II and the ways in which we really did have a kind of rapid industrialization of our food system. And then at the same time, we had increasing sort of social change, you know, political change and ways in which people understood
that there were some downfalls of the move towards industrial technology and the sort of modern lifestyle. And so where you see a lot of these artisan practices going on tend to be in places where you had a lot of social change movements in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and the Back to the Land movement. And then from that came a group of people who really started getting invested in the landscape and trying to live a certain type of life. It's in like its third or fourth generation from that now. But also in urban areas, you had the people who were sort of wanted to understand themselves as sophisticated and connoisseurs of good food shifting from a European model to this artisan model. So you have a kind of increased production of this kind of approach and increased interest by consumers in that approach.
Well, we've been doing a lot of talking about taste, so put on your chef hat for the moment. We're going to do a little exercise right now. Think of your favorite cheese, mm-hmm. whatever that is. Give me chef talk mm-hmm. about how it tastes.
There's a cheese that's being made in Vermont that is based on an English model, which is called cloth-bound cheddar. Cheddar is a very quintessential, sort of understood as a quintessential American cheese in a way, and it's made a lot in New England, and also Wisconsin is very well known for its cheddar. But it has been traditionally just the cheddaring process has then stopped, and then you age the cheese simply like that. But in a cloth-bound cheddar, you actually brush the cheese with lard, and then you encase it in cloth, and then you let natural molds ripen on it, and then you age it for a long time. You have still the traces of the tanginess of the cheddar. And you still have that nice texture of a cheddar where there's a kind of a crumbliness to it. So I love cloth-bound cheddar. And there's two people making cloth-bound cheddar in Vermont, Cabot Cloth-Bound and Shelburne Farms. And it's just amazing. It's a lovely cheese.
Amy Trubeck is an associate professor in the Nutrition and Food Science Department at the University of Vermont. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Her book is The Taste of Place, A Cultural Journey into Terroir. We'll be getting a taste of southern Indiana with Chef Daniel Orr and some forage spring mushrooms coming up after that.
If you phrase it as a hippy-dippy kind of concept from California, then everyone's going to be against it just on principle, right?
What it takes to grow and sell local veggies in Wyoming, coming up. As we pause briefly, let me also mention again that we're looking to add more members to our ranks. You can support Earth Eats at eartheats.org. Click Give Now in the upper right, WFIU Public Radio, and add your contribution to the pot. And a big thank you. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations, bloomingfoods.coop. Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Today we're going to be cooking some chicken mushrooms. The reason they call this chicken mushroom is that it really does have the taste and texture of chicken.
Morels are just now starting to pop up. Foragers can also keep an eye out for these bright orange mushrooms while they're walking in the woods. And here's how to cook them.
So we're just going to take these over to the stove, and I'll do a quick sauté with them.
A very healthy serving of butter in there in a hot pan.
Yeah, I would say that's about a half a cup of butter, but we have about 2 pounds of mushrooms. And these mushrooms can tend to be a touch on the dry side. You'll see that I'm going to add a little liquid, kind of like it's going to be between a saute and a braise. And what that will do is it will encourage the butter to be absorbed by the mushrooms, and it'll make the mushrooms a little more tender. All right, these are starting to get nice and hot. I'm going to add my garlic scapes. So to about 4 cups of mushrooms, about 1 cup of garlic scapes chopped up. I'm going to add a little bit of braising liquid, otherwise known as water. I'm going to let a little more of the liquid evaporate out of them. And then I'm just going to put a little more butter. And that's going to make them much more luxurious and give a great mouthfeel to them.
Now again,
these mushrooms, they might feed 10 people. You know, so if we use these as a garnish on a salad. So, you know, there is quite a bit of butter, but we're not going to eat a whole bunch of them.
All right.
I just took some of that nice buttery mushroom and scape juice and spooned that around the outside of the mound of mushrooms and just keeping it simple. Bon appetit.
In the kitchen with us, Chef Daniel Orr. See this recipe at eartheats.org. While food hubs and farmers markets have sprouted up in urban areas, the local food economy has been slower to take off in much of rural America. Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports on the unexpected push to create hyper-dense, super-efficient farms in the land of wide-open spaces.
Nate Story's greenhouse in Laramie, Wyoming is packed with vegetables growing in long, upright plastic towers.
Okay, well, let's hook on in and we'll start telling you how we do things.
Story's setup is an urban farmer's dream. The waste from fish tanks fertilizes the crops through plastic tubing that drips water onto the vertical garden. The greenhouse is small, but produces a lot of food. And like a proud father, he shows off bok choy, butter lettuce, and spinach.
You can grow anything. We've grown tomatoes and very large statured crops, watermelons. It will all grow.
Wait, watermelons?
Yeah, watermelons. It works until they're about 20 pounds apiece, and then things start falling.
Outside the greenhouse, the wind howls, the winters are frigid, and the soil is either silty or clay-like. If you want to grow stuff people actually eat in Wyoming, Story says you have to do it indoors. Story pitches his business as a local economic generator that produces fresh food, replacing some of the produce shipped from thousands of miles away.
I mean, our community's been incredibly supportive. Are they really with us on the urban farming, you know, level? Not necessarily, because they're not urban people. You know, they're largely rural people.
Talking about Wyoming, the superlatives come easy. Its farms and ranches are the largest in the country. It has the fewest number of vegetable farms of any state. There are more acres of vegetables growing in Alaska. Beef is king in Wyoming. So when Story started his business called Bright Agrotech, building equipment for urban farmers, it raised some eyebrows.
If you phrase it as the hippy-dippy kind of concept from California, then everyone's going to be against it just on principle, right? But if you phrase it as a community-oriented economics thing, then everyone is behind it, because that's a very long and strong tradition in Wyoming.
Wyoming is considered by many to be just a small town with really, really long streets.
That's Karen Panter, a University of Wyoming horticulture extension specialist.
Because we are a rural state, we don't have or did not historically have a lot of our own production. Virtually everything other than beef and, you know, maybe a few other crops historically have been brought in from other states or from abroad.
Panter says until recently, there just wasn't an interest in growing large quantities of vegetables in Wyoming. But that's changing. The number of greenhouses here tripled from 2007 to 2012.
Yeah, there is a lot of conservative thinking in Wyoming, and, you know, people don't see it as a food production state.
Nona Yahia is one of the architects behind Vertical Harvest, a high-density, 3-story greenhouse currently under construction in the ritzy ski town of Jackson, Wyoming. Its high-end restaurants and wealthy visitors make Jackson the ideal market for local food. But
Jackson has a very short growing period, right? We can only grow food really 4 months at best. And so there is a pretty strong local food movement, but unfortunately, it's quite short-lived in terms of our seasons.
That means the hotels, grocery stores, and schools in Jackson that are clamoring to source locally are, for the most part, out of luck. Food hubs have taken off in other parts of the country to coordinate local food distribution and production. But the entire state of Wyoming is without one, though a hub is in the planning stages in the state's northern Bighorn Basin.
This is where we start our seeds, so this is our seedling.
At Nate Story's greenhouse in Laramie, a handful of gardeners transfers little sprouts into their new homes in the plastic towers.
This time last year, we were a four-person organization, and we're 16 people now. I mean, we've quadrupled our workforce.
Story says most of his new hires are young university grads interested in farming. And until now, they've had few opportunities to grow food in the land of wide open spaces. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Stories that are rooted in America's farms from Harvest Public Media. Connect with this reporting team at harvestpublicmedia.org. Farmers market season is officially underway. It's still too early for much fresh produce in the Midwest. But if you're looking for starter plants or prepared foods, you have lots to choose from. We'll be including voices of area farmers in the show over the next several months. Today, we visit with Rosie Sill of Earth Song Farm. She bundled up today since temps are hovering around freezing.
I'll take it, though. I mean, I'll take it over rain and freezing temperatures.
She says she's been decked out in winter clothes for much of the early spring.
It snowed really late this winter, so when we were feeling like it was time for spring, it started to snow. And then we got hammered with several snowstorms, and then it got really cold. Then it rained, and it just keeps raining. So it has taken us a little bit longer to actually get into our field. Finally, this past week, we're finally working the earth and sowing seed out in the field. So I do feel like it's taking a little bit longer for spring to actually bloom, you know, basically.
But thanks to her high tunnel, the beautiful beets she has for sale today have been growing and thriving since September.
So a high tunnel is like a greenhouse. And within that high tunnel, they had their own little snug low tunnel. So they were under a couple of layers of plastic. So these beets have lived through the winter. So not only are you getting a delicious beet, you're like getting that strong, hearty energy, I feel like.
How does Rosie suggest cooking the beets?
Have a good day.
Simply steamed with lots of butter. Earth Song Farm is located in Greene County, Indiana. Listen for more farmer conversations on Earth Eats. Subscribe to our podcast feed on iTunes. Earth Eats is a team effort with Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and all the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Blooming Foods, locally grown since 1976, offering bushels of locally sourced products throughout all its locations. Bloomingfoods.coop. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thank you for being with us today. I do hope you'll take a moment before you head to the farmer's market or before you sit down to eat to become a member of Earth Eats. It's easy, it's quick. And it's what keeps us going week in and week out. EarthEats.org is the website. Find the Give Now button in the upper right. Choose WFIU Public Radio. And thanks. I'm Annie Corrigan.